Yes, well, thank you very much for that, and I'm impressed by your memory of these various encounters. I do have to explain that in the 1990s, this was the moment of the sensation of the play Copenhagen. Also, which is based in part on a book by a historian whose work I knew quite well on Heisenberg. And I had just come, I think, at that moment from having had the occasion to do a reading from the play for a dinner society in Austin, in which the parts of Niels and Margrethe Bohr were played by Steve and Louise Weinberg, the great cosmologist and his wife, and I played the part of Werner Heisenberg. So it's an interesting experience. It was also a debate over the plausibility of that thesis, and it was my pleasure to give Steve Weinberg a bit of a lesson in how much more difficult history is than physics. My title actually is Keynes in the 21st Century, with quotation marks carefully placed around in the 21st century, and a subtitle, Tradition, Circumstance, Fad, and Pretense in the Wake of the Great Crisis. So the title is both a reference and a wisecrack. A book by that title might have potential, but I think I won't write it. The great economic crisis of the 20th century began in 1930. The world has been slow to realize, Keynes wrote that year, that we are living through one of the greatest catastrophes of modern economic history. In point of fact, though, in the United Kingdom, the Depression had been underway. The mechanisms launching the Depression had been put in place years before. And many of the policy proposals that would later come to be thought of by most people as Keynesian, the economics of John Maynard Keynes, had already been made. They had been made in the pamphlet, We Can Conquer Unemployment, on which Keynes collaborated in the campaign of the Liberal Party of David Lloyd George in 1929, and they had been made in Keynes's own very famous pamphlet, Can Lloyd George Do It? So some of the concepts, including the employment multiplier, which Richard Kahn had developed, were already by that point in place. They were novel for most people, but they were certainly in the back or even in the front of Keynes's mind. The task of reconstructing economics for the economists was something that happened on a slower schedule. Perhaps it wasn't as urgent as the task of deciding what to do. In fact, it certainly wasn't as urgent. The Treatise on Money, as I recall, came out in 1933, maybe a little earlier, 1930. Yeah. In any event, it wasn't until 1936 that the general theory appeared, and that was 3 years already into the New Deal. In fact, by that time, and this is a point which has been very substantially forgotten, glossed over, and neglected, or anyway, gotten wrong, including by many prominent people who would describe themselves as Keynesian. The Great Depression in the United States, to contemporaries, was already over. Something that was thought of as having been a phrase to capture the 4 years 1930 through 1933, through the start of 1933. And from 1933 to 1936, the United States had already enjoyed what were and would remain the most rapid rates of economic growth in peacetime history, whose success was demonstrated by the fact that Franklin Roosevelt was elected, re-elected in 1936, with a crushing majority that included every state except Maine and Vermont. Okay. What the general theory did, this is to again revert to some parallels between economics and physics, was to take a discipline that had been modeled after Newtonian mechanics, with money playing the role of absolute time as a veil or a measure, but with no active role in the order of things, and it reconfigured that discipline in the spirit of at least special relativity. The choice of title, the general theory of X, Y, and Z, was not incidental. It was, as Keynes appreciated, something that contemporaries would know, a direct reference to Einstein. And in case you didn't get it, there was, and there is in the second chapter, a specific passage, which I think I can recall from memory, that the classical economists are like Euclidean geometers in a non-Euclidean world, whose only recourse upon seeing that lines apparently parallel meet is to rebuke them for the collisions that are unfortunately occurring. That's straight out of the opening passages of the special and general theory of relativity. There was, in short, to be in economics a universe whole and entire, where space would tell matter where to go and matter would tell space how to curve. That was the expression, I believe, of John Archibald Wheeler. And where monetary production, which was the title of lectures that Keynes gave in 1933, was the analog to space-time. That is to say, the linking together of two concepts that had previously been held as distinct. Understanding that we live in a monetary and credit world, and that the monetary processes cannot be separated from the processes of production. This was what came to be known as macroeconomics, okay? In which there is a determination of employment not in an isolated market called the labor market. The whole business of Chapter 2, the general theory, is to get rid of this concept of a supply curve of labor, to abolish it like the axiom of parallels, right? And to replace the determination of employment, to place it firmly in the context of the scale of the economic universe as a whole. Employment to be determined by business spending, which is in turn to be determined by the summing up of the elements of total effective aggregate demand. Well, as we all know, in the 6 or 7 decades following this moment, and really starting quite early with the interpretation of Keynes by his reviewers as a fixed-wage theorist, just another version of the Treasury view of 1929, the insight on the structure of Keynes's thought was completely lost. Keynes was simplified, he was modified, he was undermined. He was forced onto the Procrustean bed or into the intellectual coffin of equilibrium analysis. His vision was obliterated, a defeat as thorough as that of Malthus by Ricardo. Micro foundations and rational expectations conquered economics as the Holy Inquisition conquered Spain. Controversy ceased. The great puzzle of effective demand disappeared from sight. John Maynard Keynes himself was exiled to the underworld of Karl Marx, Major Douglas, and Silvio Gisell. And then a doctrine with the vile, with the reprehensible name of New Keynesianism appeared. It bore no relationship to Keynes or his theory. It was not enough in the end to kill the man and bury the body in a maneuver straight from the pages of Orwell. The anti-Keynesians went into the graveyard and stole the name from the headstone above the tomb. I don't think this was accidental. It has created an environment in which recovering the original thoughts and stating a analysis rooted in those insights is much more difficult than it was before. And of course, the great declaration of consensus around these positions was made at the most exquisite of all possible moments, when in, I think, 2007, the American Economic Association has got a session on how the world reached consensus on monetary policy. You couldn't have chosen a better moment for a declaration of complete victory on the terrain of intellectual debate. Even as the collapse was already underway and had been for months. Fantastic. But the crisis came. Not surprisingly, conditions for it had been facilitated and set up in every which way by this sequence of events. It was therefore, I think, to be expected and indeed admirable that at that time there were still a few distinguished veterans of the earlier battles and who had carried this particular torch for many years, who took the chance to attempt to bring back the Keynes that they knew and whose spirit and ideas continued to have a bearing on these circumstances, because in fact they continued to be to capture the essence of the issues. Robert Skidelsky and Paul Davidson both attempted this task. We can see now that it was a brave but not a successful effort. Would have been much more difficult to bring back Keynes in the environment and the intellectual climate of the Great Crisis, when he had already been killed and buried, than it was in the original crisis of the 1930s, when he was, first of all, alive himself, but secondly, the defenses against his ideas had not been so effectively prepared. Another effort, considerably more successful in the public realm, at least for a time, was the invocation of Keynes's name in support of the policy measures, which, as I said before, had already been developed before the general theory, and while they took reinforcement and support from the general theory, did not, I think, actually depend upon it. That policy measures, which in the 1930s had been already supported by people like Arthur Pigou. The stimulus programs, whose purpose initially was to simply assist a process of economic recovery of return to normal, of reestablishment of the previously existing, allegedly, to be expected economic conditions. This argument partook of some phrases and metaphors that Keynes himself had used at various points, including in the Essays in Persuasion. Paul Krugman liked to quote Keynes on the question of magneto trouble. We have magneto trouble. A small mechanical problem, as Keynes said, is appropriate to the question that the solution should be found in a device. But actually, if you examine the substantial content of the programs advanced by people who basically said, well, we just stimulate our way out of this, their underlying apparent diagnosis is even simpler than that. It's not mechanical difficulty at all. It's simply an empty fuel tank. Or a battery that has run out of charge. Power it up, turn the ignition, and off we go. That was, I think, the essence of it. 6 years later, we find that the vehicle has not moved very far. And this does invite the riposte, which we have heard many times from these quarters, which is, well, they should have listened to me. More gas in the tank, a better charge on the battery, and we could have been much further ahead. Admittedly, it's very hard to refute that on the face. In some sense, it's a theoretical proposition. But it's also, I think, fair to say that as a political matter, the refrain, they should have listened to me, is not a winning hand. It begins to wear on people's nerves after a while. And I think the advocates of that position 6 years ago, particularly in the United States, have to some degree sensed this, and we have a move on their part to adopt a somewhat more, somewhat stronger, but also more pessimistic analysis. The initiative here was taken, I think we can fairly credit Larry Summers, with Paul Krugman coming quite quickly into support, and that was and is to revive and invoke the doctrine of secular stagnation. Going back not to Keynes, I don't believe directly, but to Alvin Hansen, the vision of, I think, drawn substantially from an ISLM framework of a flat LM curve bounded at zero by the institutional nature of the interest rate, alongside a collapse of animal spirits affecting the IS curve. That surely is closer to capturing the case. It certainly gives a more coherent description of what has happened in the last 6 years than the previous expressions of that the cure would be based upon it measures which were, in another famous phrase from 6 years ago, targeted, timely, and temporary. That is to say, simply designed to reanimate a system which was had been interrupted by an exogenous shock. So we are moving from an analysis of a healthy system distracted momentarily by outside events, the asteroid theory, if you like, it's a great crisis, to one in which there are internal forces that have to be confronted, and yet the internal forces are not very powerful in this model. They are essentially psychological. They could be overcome, and in his present interventions, Larry Summers has become a full-throated fiscal Keynesian, believes that they can be overcome simply by animating the public sector to do the investment, which is certainly needed at this point, and which the private sector is not interested in taking on. So thought is moving. These are formidable figures in our time, powerful public voices. But I would suggest that thought is not moving quickly or far enough. Keynes himself had a friendly, I don't know how extensive, I don't think very extensive, but a friendly correspondence with John R. Commons. And I would like to suggest that it is not anti-Keynesian at this point. It is not out of the spirit of Keynes's own time to invoke a certain amount of institutionalism in thinking and discussing the situation that we face. In fact, I think you can find this very much in spirit in the Keynes, which I often use as a way of introducing students to him, and which I still think is, I think anybody who knows his work has to recognize as a text of extraordinary power, the Keynes of the Economic Consequences of the Peace. A Keynes who combined a certain amount of already present macroeconomic insight, insight about the interdependence of countries, with a very direct and topical analysis of the political and economic situation of the hour. So in that spirit, and without trying at this point to remain too strictly within the framework, although I think, in fact, in almost each case you can find, in fact, in each case you can find antecedents in Keynes' work, I want to bring up four questions that strike me as questions that we as economists need to have firmly in view. In many cases we are spending time on them, but we need to integrate them into a joint and common framework for thinking about the question. First is resources. Resources including the ultimate resource of the atmosphere, but especially the direct problem of the cost of fundamental resources, especially energy. In the 1930s, especially in North America, these were cheap. This is the age in which the East Texas oil field is coming online. And although an older generation of technologies was in crisis, a newer generation was firmly on the way and had been since the First World War. The constraint of resource costs was not, therefore, much of an issue for Keynes, although it was certainly on certain parts of the European continent at that time. After 1970, and again after 2000, resources became expensive. In the run-up to the Great Crisis in 2008, the price of oil reached $148 a barrel before it collapsed. And that little aspect of the history was quickly forgotten. But it had, of course, an income effect, which contributed to the strong reaction of spending to later events. What's the situation now? I think the situation now is characterized by, in the first place, uncertainty about the outlook. When I first started trying to call attention to this 5 years ago, we did not have a clear picture of the scale of natural gas from hydrofracking. It's now clear that whether you like this or not, it's a vast phenomenon. What is not clear is how long it will last. That's what the geophysicists are working on, but they do not know, and they probably can't know until it starts to run out, at which point it will be a little late to have made the discovery. So it goes. Second point about resource costs is that, in contrast to previous eras, they are very heavily financialized. And therefore, they have an intrinsic instability associated with the capacity of the financial markets, of speculators and hoarders, to hold them back when demand is rising, driving up the price faster than the available supply. Something which I've called the choke chain effect. And that has a dual effect on investments. If you are an energy user, you have to worry that the price may be too high. If you are a producer of alternatives, you have to worry that it may be too low. That's a problem that's out there. It hasn't been overcome. For a generation, at least actually two generations, in different ways, in the post-war period, the generation up to 1970s and the generation afterwards, the problem of access to resources was at least modified and mitigated by a world system in which you had stabilizing hegemonic power. Initially, a system which achieved a certain stability and balance between the East and the West in the Cold War. And after the decline and fall of the Soviet Union, a system which was for a long time sought to be guaranteed by a single hegemonic power, namely that of the United States, with its center of force projected onto the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. I think that it is fair to say, as a general rule, that no sensible person has a lot of confidence in the long-term future of that system. A system of stabilizing power that relies on a single country and in part on its military force depends upon global confidence in the sensible governance of that country, in the restraint in the use of power, and in the effectiveness of the military force. The United States has not done a very good job of inspiring confidence on the first point. And on the second, the military force has actually been tested in the last decade, tested in a largely open country and an urban setting in Iraq, and then in the rather difficult mountainous terrain in Afghanistan, and not proven to be particularly effective in either place, with the result that my guess is military professionals in the United States would be quite content if they're never deployed south of the Rio Grande again. In fact, it's not just a guess. I know a lot of senior military officers and how they have absorbed the cautionary tales of the world situation, the cautionary experiences of the last decade. It's furthermore plain that the world is not a self-governing place, and so a great deal of future instability will follow upon the disappearance of the stabilizing framework, whatever you may have thought of it at the time. The third area I'd like to raise for you concerns a discussion that many economists are already having, and that is the effect of technological change on the prospects for employment. The new technologies, the digital revolution, which has been underway, of course, for quite a long time. Schumpeter taught us that technological revolutions have a creative and a destructive phase. The creative phase comes first, when the ideas are being developed and when there is a rush of investment activity in this pursuit of large prizes, which in the nature of things only a few people can gain. But the fact that great many people seek them and put lay out resources in the effort is an overall, this is a source of economic booms. It's a source of credit booms. It's the source of the information technology boom that brought the United States to full employment for 4 solid years in the late 1990s. But once the technologies are established and they spread, they have a destructive phase. They undermine and ultimately destroy a vast array of previously existing activities. And that is plainly what is happening in the digital age. Economists are tending to approach this with an econometric rather than a theoretical point of view, and in my opinion, that is a risk, because one can show, I think it's effectively been shown by people who do this work carefully, that the relationship between GDP and jobs hasn't changed all that much. Okay. So it's not a question of capital labor substitution in the neoclassical sense. And that the great loss of jobs is post-crisis, not before. And so one can make the argument, post hoc, ergo propter hoc, that it's demand rather than supply. Post hoc, ergo propter hoc, however, is a risky proposition. And the argument I would make is that the timing and the substance cannot really be separated. You cannot use the timing to make a definitive statement about the substance of the issue, that what actually happens in the world is that businesses do not lay off their workers until they have to. They like to go on their present business models, but when they are hit by a major slump, they do shrink their workforces, and in the aftermath, they have to choose. Do we hire them back, or do we look for a less expensive way to operate? And the less expensive way to operate is available in many, many cases. And it's available because the technologies replace both capital and labor. Right? They're cheaper, which means that explains why the GDP labor employment ratio doesn't change that much. And because the tax structures favor equipment over employment. They're not, machines once purchased are not taxed a second time, whereas labor is taxed on a continuing basis. There's something else going on here which I think is interesting, and I don't have an estimate of its empirical significance, but there are plenty of things which the statisticians will be the last to know. And that is, if you look at the internal combustion engine revolution or the electrical power revolution of the last century, it's plain that having replaced the horse, right, which was actually very bad for full employment amongst the horses, the motor vehicle created a large train of secondary occupations. They have to be maintained, they have to be repaired, they have to The roads have to be built and maintained. A whole body of infrastructure depended upon this particular technology, which created a lot of secondary jobs, which were not jobs in the automobile or the trucking industry. It's not at all clear that the digital technologies had the same effect. It's also true that electrical appliances, for example, displaced people from the household to the market. And so for a long period, you have an increment, I don't know how big, to GDP, that comes from the fact that previously existing activities are being marketized. And I think it's at least a plausible argument that we're going through a period in which previously existing market activities are becoming demarketized. Communication, for example. Information transfer of all kinds, which once occurred on a variable cost basis, now occurs on a fixed cost basis. That seems to me ought to give us a cumulatively lower level of measured market output over time. And the sources of labor saving are to be found just about anywhere. I have a nice example. I have a friend who is an economist for Federal Express, and he tells me that these things are having a bad effect on the air freight business between Asia and the United States. Now, why do you suppose? Any thoughts?
You mean the production or?
No, on the freight business, on the shipping. Answer is very straightforward. I'm holding it in my hand. These things are very small. You can put an awful lot of them into a large airplane. They replace fax machines, cameras, God knows what, that previously went on those airplanes. The airplanes are sitting idle. Doesn't take as many as it used to. It's good for the environment. It's good for efficiency, not so good for the pilots. Fourth area. Keynes in the treatise makes clear that there are two sources of monetary production: government, the banking system. There's government money and there's bank money. These are motive forces. And it is, of course, and particularly in the last generation since the early 1980s, but bank money that has driven our economy forward in periodic bursts. Right? Periodic bursts of ever-declining underlying quality. Information technology followed by real estate, interrupted only by, in the United States, by a brief period of military spending, which is traditional government money. Okay. Well, in order for that to happen again, banks have to have in view profitable employment generating activity that they wish to finance. They have to have clients to whom they wish to lend. And the problem with really major credit busts is that the clients tend to disappear, and they tend to disappear for a long time because the value of their collateral, which is either business expectations or the value of real estate and housing, falls below previously established levels of debt. And bankers become very wary. And on top of that, you have the problem of fraud. It's very clear that the general model of bank-financed, credit market-financed activity in the run-up to the Great Crisis was suffused with criminal behavior. And I talked about this last time I was here. Well, when it becomes clear that all of the major institutions with which one has to deal, the commercial banks, the investment banks, the ratings agencies, the regulators, are part of a vast criminal conspiracy, and I use those words with technical precision, I'm not trying to be dramatic, then there is a tendency to lose trust in such people and in the system as a whole, which means it's not just the banks, but the people who have investable resources are also extremely wary of deploying them outside of the safest instruments, which are, of course, in the modern world, treasury,
bonds and the long-term, or the paper of other governments that are not going to collapse. Germany, France, the UK, Japan. Not a very large sink. The banks themselves were saved in the aftermath of the crisis on the hypothesis, or the alleged hypothesis, that they would reanimate credit, get credit flowing again, restore confidence. On the apparent assumption that they, the arbiters of the credit market, were the judges of morality amongst everyone else, and that the real problem were the borrowers, inept mortgage takers in the United States, and of course, feckless Mediterranean peoples in Europe. But that's not, by any means, the full story. I could argue for you, I would argue for you, if you want an analogy to the modern banking system, it's the ministry, it's the machinery ministries of the late period USSR, which absorbed about 40% of total output in the last years of that country and produced nothing. Banks these days produce, get maybe 10% of all wages in the United States and 40% of the profits, so it's not entirely out of scale with that comparison. It is a big problem when you have to support large institutions, in this case by the differential between the interest you get and the interest you pay, and they don't do anything in return. There is an additional institutional complication which of course afflicts Europe and is distinctive to this region, and that is the Confederacy, which was created under the various European treaties. A confederacy is a system of quasi-sovereign states that do not act in mutual support, of states that operate on the voluntary extension of credit and the voluntary extension of repayment. In the United States, the debt problem is a problem largely of private debts, household debts. And the thing about households is that they default, walking away from their debts, or they pay them down, or they die. And therefore, over time, household debts, after a crisis, tend to diminish as a share of the difficulties, as a source of difficulties. Sovereign debts in the Eurozone don't have that property. They persist until they are negotiated away. And to negotiate them away, you have to have a negotiation, which means an agreement between the creditors and the debtors. The alternative is a series of essentially accumulating Ponzi's, which may defer the crisis, but act as, in effect, a massive contingent tax or an actual tax on the crisis regions and are an absolute obstacle to economic recovery. This comes to the question that we were talking about earlier with Peter Scott about the role of the interest rate. And it thinks that it's clear that when you have interest being paid to the outside in a currency you cannot depreciate, then the interest rate would remain in that debt sustainability equation. It is a formula for an eventual confrontation. And I suspect everybody knows it. And if I had to offer a guess, and I'm not a betting man, I would bet it will come to a head before too very long. These are complex questions. And, of course, to come to the second part of my subtitle, Pretense and Fad in the Wake of the Great Crisis. In certain quarters, they trigger a very customary response, which is simple-minded utopian extremism. I think we're seeing this response now in full cry, and it has two important dimensions. One is the assertion of a very simple framework for the problem. That framework, and I say this with a twinge of regret because I've been working on this topic for 20 years, the framework is clearly inequality as a broad abstract theme. A framework capable of mobilizing a certain political sensibility and of a certain level of abstract modeling. But if you resolve everything to a Gini coefficient, or the share of the top 1% or the top 0.1% in tax filings, in income as recorded by tax filings, and if you treat those phenomena as, let's say, abstract and fundamental realities of all economic systems, what you are doing is sweeping everything else under the rug. You're saving yourself an enormous amount of intellectual effort and of the need for a very large amount of historical and institutional knowledge. And this feeds into the second part of the problem, which is a tendency to advance extreme and impractical measures, either in ignorance of how extreme and how impractical they are, or in full knowledge of that, in order to incite the naive. It's good for book sales. We have before us these days the proposition, which I must say could not have even dreamed of myself, of a global annual tax on the market capitalization of wealth in all of its marketable forms. One has to admit that as an employment policy, it's an act of genius, because it would take 2/3 of the people in this room to act as the assessors of the capital value on a minute-to-minute basis of the financial wealth of the remaining third. There would never be a shortage of labor under this system. Okay, enough said about that. But one can see the phenomenon of the sweeping fad, warmly received in certain corners of the mainstream, which can serve very effectively as a political diversion. Let the buyer beware. What's the alternative? The alternative is a certain kind of hardworking modesty. I'm the co-author with Yanis Varoufakis and Stuart Holland of a proposal. We call it the modest proposal. I don't lay that out as the one objective thing, but the word modest is important. It's a double irony. Obviously, it's a reference to Swift with his eating of the Irish babies. But it's an irony on the top of that, because our proposal really is modest. It has elements addressed in the European context to specific identifiable problems within the framework of existing institutions, charters, and treaties that can be acted on within the framework of those existing charters, institutions, and treaties. They deal with the debt, deal with the banks, get an investment program going, a jobs program, set up a system of social insurance and solidarity that provides basic protections, which certain parts of the European Confederation now lack, and which can be used as a political weapon to fend off the rise of fascism, an increasing threat in some parts of the Eurozone. They would buy time to have a reasonable and unpanicked discussion of institutional arrangements, one not driven by some utopian ideal, but by a rational discussion. They would buy time to begin to refocus attention on the issues that we all know have to be dealt with if we wish to avoid disaster in the longer run, and in particular the problem of global warming, which of course is completely unheard of here in Denmark on days like today. It's not easy stuff. In fact, it's the hard way to proceed. But it is, let me suggest, the path of plain common sense, and a diligent economist should be a common sense economist. Should be one who knows a particular area and is capable of expressing with some clarity and depth of knowledge in a persuasive way the best way to proceed. It's an old and, I think, Keynesian idea. Or it was Keynes who wrote that we should rise to the level of dentists if we can, and who, in specific reference to the greatest problem that he faced, which was mass unemployment, he wrote that the idea, the conservative idea, that 10% of the workforce should be kept idle is crazily improbable. No one could believe, who had not had their brain fuddled by nonsense for years and years. Thank you very much.